process be given more time. Saddam, a once ally who had the full support of the U.S. and Western countries during his 8-year war against Iran, had finally grown too defiant for the U.S. to tolerate. The Iraq war, estimated to have cost the U.S. nearly $5.5 trillion and over 4,500 deaths among its servicemen. For Iraqis, the cost was much higher. More than 1 million people were killed and millions displaced, while millions more continue to face insecurity and poverty. Birth defects and cancer rates also sharply increased as foreign forces used depleted uranium weapons in civilian areas. 19 years on since the U.S.-led invasion, the war agents are yet to be charged for any of their crimes.
War on Iraq was one of 8 wars in West Asia and North Africa, which the U.S. was carrying out in service of its plans to create a so-called New Middle East, where the entire region would be under the tutelage of the U.S. and its key allies, Israel and the Saudis.
The U.S. announced ending its combat mission in 2011, but 3 years later it started boosting deployment again, this time under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Throughout recent years, there have been multiple reports of Washington's nexus with the Takfiri terrorists, while Iraqis, with the help of the regional resistance front, were fighting themselves to eliminate Daesh.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster, RT, stripped of its broadcasting license in the UK.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Watansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems like, of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RT falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Saeed Puriza, London.
The outrage was palpable at today's protest. A Freedom of Information request revealed this week that racism was a factor in the Metropolitan Police's horrific strip search of a schoolgirl known as Child Q in 2020. She was forced to bend over for two female police officers to look at her private parts. No other trusted adult was present and her parents weren't informed. The Met officers are now under investigation. Some assert that the strip search of Child Q was an isolated incident, a crime perpetrated by a few bad apples. But members of the community disagree.
I think this feels a systematic approach that the police use. They may now regret using it in this particular instance. They may say that. How people could conceptualize strip searching a girl in school without her mum knowing about it, without an adult present, it's just heartbreaking.
Child Q has launched legal proceedings against the Metropolitan Police and her school. Many prominent figures have offered their support. The school called the police on Child Q, saying she smelt of marijuana. The strip search yielded no evidence of her being in possession of drugs.
They're out here in the streets in our schools to defend their interests. They're out here to discipline us, to create and sow and violently enforce the divisions that the ruling class needs in order to rule us and oppress us.
Now black families are torn on how to safeguard their children, to make them aware of the dangers without terrifying them of going to school.
I had to take my children out of a previous school because the black children are being treated different than the white children in schools in London, in England. And that needs to stop. I have girls a similar age to this woman, to this young woman that's happened to, and I'm so emotional about it that I can't even speak about it.
I used to work with children in homes, looked after children, and sometimes the children would complain that they were abused in the station. They ain't got no trust for the police, they ain't got no trust for society, for social care, they ain't got no trust anymore.
Horrified but not surprised, that was the reaction of many here today. In the past 5 years, more than 172,000 strip searches have been conducted in London, and the statistics show black people are 3 times more likely to be targeted. There were mothers, aunties, and educators at today's protest, vowing to protect their youth. But with police being called into schools and parents alerted after the fact, how can they? Bianca Rahimi, London.
From Kurdish horses to Kurdish music and dance, this festival is all about showcasing the traditions of Iran's province of Kurdistan in celebrating the Persian New Year known as Nowruz.
I wish you a happy Nowruz. I hope that the New Year will be treating you well and the COVID pandemic will be over.
I welcome all of my fellow Iranian citizens who have come to visit Sanandaj. I wish them health and wealth in the new year.
The ceremony also saw Iranians coming from other provinces, both to get acquainted with the Kurdish culture and to showcase their own customs in celebrating Nowruz.
We've come from Sistan and Balochistan province. I'm so glad to see all Iranian ethnicities have happily gathered here to celebrate Nowruz.
I congratulate you on Nowruz. I'm from Khorasan province, and today I watched the Kurdish dance, and it was amazing.
Nowruz marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, which falls on March 21st. The ancient tradition is celebrated by some 300 million people in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other countries. That's why this event has also hosted activists from other countries.
I congratulate the arrival of Nowruz to all nations that celebrate this occasion. We in Tajikistan also mark Nowruz magnificently, as it's a time for peace and friendship. I thank the UNESCO for organizing this event.
There is so much beauty in the way Iranians celebrate Nowruz. Each city has different traditions in marking Nowruz, and that is exciting. We in Afghanistan do share some of the traditions here.
Unlike Iran, in Afghanistan we don't have the haft-seen spread, but we do have haft-miveh, which is a spread with 7 different fruits prepared on the turn of the year. I think we're here to celebrate these differences as they make Nowruz a diverse festivity.
Initiated by the UNESCO's Tehran office, the ceremony came as part of the caravan of Nowruz, which set out from the city of Hamadan, stopped in Kermanshah, and wrapped up in Kurdistan, bringing together representatives from each Iranian province to showcase their Nowruz traditions.
Their return to British soil, like their period of incarceration, a media event of the highest order. British Iranians, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, and a Nusheh Shuri touched down at Bryce Norton Air Base in the early hours of Thursday morning. Both had been jailed on espionage charges in Iran. Their release comes after months of delicate negotiations and culminated in their freedom, according to a statement from Iran's foreign ministry, on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. In what has become a media firestorm, much has been made of Britain's repayment of a historic debt to the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic has consistently rejected any links between London's repayment of a decades-old debt and the release of the British Iranian nationals, despite attempts in Western mainstream media reporting to conflate the two issues.
We received the money a few days ago, but simultaneously the judicial process for the release of these two persons was going on. Maybe chronologically, their release and the deposit of the money were close, but there is no connection between these two issues.
UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had previously spoken of making the repayment of Iranian debt a priority.
I've also been very clear that the debt that we owe Iran is legitimate, and we are seeking ways to pay that.
The release of the two dual nationals is the culmination of years of talks between London and Tehran, including a political revelation by then Foreign Secretary, now MP Boris Johnson, that Zaghari Ratcliffe was not a charity worker, as was widely stated.
He admitted, didn't he, at the dispatch box that she was employed by Reuters in training journalists. And as I've said, that is a classic tactic that's used to, develop assets in nations that Britain has hostilities towards. So, in that sense, I think, he let the cat out of the bag. And obviously we know now that, an agreement's been reached and she's been released. But, I think that did reveal that there was a lot more to this situation than we were being told by the corporate media in this country.
Both Zaghari Ratcliffe and her employer, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, had maintained she was simply visiting family while on vacation. A third person, Morat Abbas, has also been released but remains in Iran for the time being. Amina Taylor, London.
There is consensus at the highest political and military levels in the West that closing Ukraine's airspace to Russia would likely trigger World War III and potentially result in a catastrophic nuclear war. Despite this, many EU legislators suggest it's time for NATO to become directly involved in the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Unfortunately, our good friends from Washington, they were too afraid. They were afraid that they are triggering the war, but I can't imagine where we're gonna trigger the war. Europe is in the war already.
But a debate on the subject in the European Parliament on Thursday heard calls for peace rather than further intervention.
I don't think this war can be won militarily from one side, and therefore it is essential that we do all we can to ensure there is a ceasefire.
According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue, that's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian Defense Minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist, he explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticized for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonized. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corrie from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corrie became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corrie, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corrie's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things that Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corrie acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Purizab, London.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact that the humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military cooperation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the news on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
The drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now.
Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Facility Aramco has been targeted by the Yemeni army. It was a major operation that did not include just the Aramco oil facility. It came in response to the continued Saudi aggression against the country. The war in Yemen, now in its seventh year, shows no signs of reaching a political resolve. But why? Why does Saudi Arabia continue a war that it is not winning on the ground? And why does the U.S. continue to support this war militarily? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me first introduce our guest. For this edition of The Spotlight, we have Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us. He's an activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Hamza Karim. He's a political commentator who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Hossein Abkhazi, let me first start with you, if I may. We're looking at a major attack that's taken place. It's not reported as such, but it really is a major attack. Drones that have hit the Saudi energy and water desalination facilities, looking at petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region. I can go on with this list. It's quite an extensive list. Tell us the significance of this major attack. And what type of reaction mentally could Saudi Arabia be thinking of when it receives such a blow to its facilities?
I think what the Saudi Arabia have now to do is to accept that they cannot continue with this war and to accept that Yemeni army is well equipped to target all Saudi oil infrastructure and power plant and as well as they did today, water treatment plant. Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has enforced a blockade on Yemen, killing hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians. And since Biden sworn as U.S. president, he realized that military action on Yemen against Sana'a forces has failed. That's why they have, for the last year, tightened their blockade, blocking fuel from entering Yemen. And this actually affects all water supplies and electricity supplies in Yemen. Many hospitals are running low in fuel, and there are a warning that they might be closing. And Yemeni army, when he has launched his first attack, they call it breaking the siege operation. And today we have seen three operations against Saudi Arabia, which target mainly and focused mainly on Saudi refinery and oil infrastructure, including power station. I think that Yemeni army now want to send a clear message to Saudi Arabia that the fire that that you have created in Yemen, the suffering of Yemeni civilians will be sent back to Saudi Arabia. But as well, we see on the top of all that, that all this attack, that maybe it could be more than 40 ballistic missile and drone and drones and as well cruise missile has targeted Saudi Arabia. Not a single civilian was killed, and to show you the accuracy of these weapons used today. And as well, I want to mention that in all those three operations, they have used cruise missile, and we've seen in many footage released by some Saudi media showing some fire in some of those areas that was targeted. This shows that Yemeni army now has taken the decision to break the siege by attacking Saudi and by attacking their oil infrastructure, and they must stop, or they're going to see in the coming hours or days more attack against Saudi Arabia.
Okay, some good points made there, Hamza Karim, by our guest in Sana'a. In particular, what we're looking at, again, is the depth of the number of targets that the Yemeni army has hit. And our guest there talked about the precision. And that points to the fact that you're looking at the Yemeni army to have had major advancements in its arsenal throughout the years, this being one of them, which, again, it's surprising how it's not being reported. So if you take this attack and you cite all the different points, if you're Saudi Arabia, and then you take a look at, for example, the different accomplishments of Saudi Arabia, or should I say its mercenaries on the ground, you don't see a comparison that can be even made there, because the accomplishments by the Yemeni army far outweighs what Saudi Arabia has accomplished on the ground. Doesn't that point to Saudi defeat, which requires a complete revamp of the way they're approaching this war militarily?
Absolutely, definitely. You know, if we look at the war for the past 7 years, Saudi Arabia have used all their cards in this war, starting from using really, engaging in really heavy military operations in Yemen in different front lines,
After that, they started tightening the economy of Yemen by closing the airports and the ports. They've used all the cards in Yemen to try to accomplish any of the objectives that they announced when they started this war in 2015. But after 7 years, we see that none of these objectives were achieved. And I believe, right now what they're trying to do is basically try to tighten more the siege that is imposed on Yemen to really put pressure on people and human beings there in Yemen. So this shows that really they could not accomplish anything. And, if I were in Saudi Arabia or to advise on something, is that, they need to change the way that they're dealing with this war. I think after 7 years and not being able to achieve any militarily or political, achievements there, they need to start thinking about this war in a different way. They need to start engaging in serious peace talks with Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a. There need to be some serious actions on ground to show that really they're changing of the way that they're thinking about this war. But we see that they still continue doing what they've been doing for the past 7 years, and they don't seem to be, learning from their mistakes and the way they're dealing with this war.
Okay, Hussein Abdelkaiti, on the political front, there has been some movements made there by the UN. And I believe that you are of the opinion that the talks, which I believe were set to take place in Saudi Arabia, you believe that that is the wrong move, that Yemen should not participate in the country that's doing the bombing. Also, there's a point about the siege, where the last time around where there were political talks, the siege was a point of contention where the Yemeni government said, listen, lift the siege. And yet Saudi Arabia did not do that. Why is Saudi Arabia not lifting the siege before we talk about the political movements taking place?
It's clearly that they are using the humanitarian crisis and disaster on Yemen as a weapons. All the ships that are that should be actually arriving to Hodeidah, either fuel or food, they have been searched by the United Nations and as well by the Saudi coalition. And there is a United Nations team after a Hodeidah agreement in December 2018 in Stockholm. That team has been working in Hodeidah for over 2 years. But still Saudi, because they have failed military, they think that using this humanitarian pressure, especially on fuel, which everything in Yemen and in any other country depend on fuel, they think as well in their media, they try to blame this shortages of fuel, to blame Sana'a government, because they think that they can deceive the Yemeni population. But on the other hand, we see that there are more people are joining the front line to fight Saudi Arabia. And as well, first part of your question about the Saudi suggested to have talks in Riyadh, I don't think, and as well, Sana'a should not accept this, because they have refused, especially Ansarullah, to go to Saudi Arabia before the start of this war, because Saudi has been playing a dirty part in Yemen by supporting terrorism, by supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and supporting other groups who have been targeting Yemeni civilians, either by suicide or by killing or kidnapping. That's why, it will be really, really impossible that the same country that has launched the war and you denied and refused to go in the first week of that war to talk in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia still consider what's happening in Yemen as a civil war. They think that they try to believe that they are not part of this war. And I think if Yemeni will accept that, this means that Saudi Arabia has won the war, because Saudi Arabia will not be obligated to pay any compensation for the killing of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians or for the destruction that's happening in Yemen. And I think one last thing, that when Saudi announced that they are ready to hold talks in Riyadh, I think because they know that the anniversary of the war, which is going to be on 26th of March, after maybe 10 days, they know that Yemeni army will launch a huge attack against Saudi Arabia. That's why they want to be to look like that they are the one who want peace. But I believe they don't want peace. They just want to make Yemeni civilians suffer. And now the responsibility is on Sana'a government to stop all that.
Well, we need to talk about this, because this is how this picture is being painted, Hamza Karim, in terms of how the media is wording the way that this war is taking place. And one of the things that is glaringly false is the following, where many media outlets say the violent struggle between Yemen's internationally recognized government, and I'm quoting, supported by a Saudi-led military coalition, and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Now, there are a couple of things here that are just false. When they talk about Yemen's internationally recognized governments, who is internationally recognizing this government is the first question, because when you look at what happened with elections, there was only one candidate, and that is not a criteria for a democratic election. And plus, when you talk about Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, most Yemenis don't recognize him as obviously their leader. Secondly, when they talk about this Iran-backed Houthi rebels, I mean, it's Iran does obviously support the Yemeni people. Why shouldn't it? They're being bombed. There's a harsh, severe humanitarian crisis. They're supporting that, but it kind of gives the idea militarily Iran is supporting Yemeni army and obviously the Nasrallah fighters. Why is this false narrative being, do you think, described in the way that it is?
Yeah, definitely. You know, Saudi Arabia and the international media outlets, they've been, since the war started in Yemen, they've been trying to position this war as a civil war between Yemeni parties. Now, there's definitely some internal problems between the Yemeni parties in Yemen, but this doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia is not playing the biggest role in this war. Without Saudi Arabia, this war would never have happened. When we're talking about the internationally recognized government, it's basically the government that really U.S. and Saudi Arabia wants to for them to be running Yemen. So Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi was elected in 2014 in a one-candidate election for 2 years, and then after 1 year, they extended his presidency for another year. So basically, February 2015, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi wasn't the president of Yemen, and the war was launched in March 2015. So even if we're talking about it from a legal perspective, he's not anymore the president. Now, when talking about Iran, now if you see Saudi Arabia, they've been supported by all the countries in the Western world. They've been buying arms from US, UK, France, Belgium, Germany, and a lot of other countries. How can you now try to convince Houthis that they cannot have partners and allies, but for them, they're Saudi Arabia has the right to deal with all the governments in the world when they want to impose on Ansarullah and the government in Sana'a that they can't have partners and allies. This doesn't make any sense. Saudi Arabia can have their own allies. Yemen as well are allowed, and they have the right to decide who their allies should be.
Okay, Hossein Aboukaiti, the UN is trying very hard to make sure that talks take place. My question to you is, what type of talks can lead to any type of results or for the talks to be successful unless there is a party that the Saudi coalition or Saudi Arabia has in mind, somebody other than Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi that can be part of these talks? In other words, somebody that Yemenis also accepts in order for there to be a compromise of any kind, if there is going to be one. So if they want to present Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, how can the talks even lead to any type of success?
I mean, this is actually the problem, because when they call Hadi as the legitimate president or the legitimate government, Hadi he won an election. He was the only candidate. And I mean, if the United Nations actually want to help Yemeni and to reach a peace deal or to reach a talk, they should at the beginning, accept that the Saudi is committing a war crime against Yemen by blocking food and fuel, by closing airport and port across Yemen, by preventing ships and fuel shipment to enter Yemen. I mean, this is a war crime. It doesn't matter who's in this war. And as well, they keep calling the war in Yemen, they call it as a Yemeni crisis or a civil war. So if the United Nations will not accept that Saudi Arabia is a major part in this war, and as well Sana'a forces, and as well other parties, and at that point, then Yemenis, I'm sure that they will accept any talk, but it should be in a country that is not involved in this war. They have suggested many months that Muscat or Oman could be that place, but why Saudi Arabia did not accept that? Because they want to make a win from any political talks to be held in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia actually want to make Yemeni feel that they are the one who opened Riyadh for them to reach a peace deal, and that they are the one who have struck this deal. But to be honest with the United Nations has been biased from the beginning of the war. And sure. As an example, the attack that has been taking place as an example on Sana'a many years ago, killing 1,000 Yemeni civilians on the Great Hall, funeral hall, United Nations has called it as an incident, and they have never ever condemned Saudi Arabia. Okay. United Nations now as well is a biased, and they could not be part of any future deal.
All right. We have not talked about the U.S. here, which I'm going to ask you, Hamza Karim. What are we looking at when it comes to the U.S.? The media somewhat paints the picture now that they're somewhat confused as to what they're going to do. But when you take a look at the facts, arms sales continue. So what is the U.S. position in a minute, less than a minute, if you can say it?
Sure. You know, Saudi Arabia, this is their war in Yemen. U.S. is... This is the war of the U.S. in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is being used as a tool by U.S. We all remember in 2015 when the war started. It started from it was announced from the White House in Washington. Without the arms sales that and the logistics support and the intelligence support that Saudi Arabia has been given by U.S., this war wouldn't continue, okay. And Saudi Arabia wouldn't be able to defend itself. So definitely, U.S. is playing the major role here in this war.
Thank you for that, Hamza Karim, political commentator from Toronto. Hussein Abughaisi, many thanks, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tagway. And the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today, not in the mood to watch TV. I'd better turn it off. Just one thing can excite me now: a cup of aromatic Iranian tea. Pleasant. just remembered. I had plans to visit the Golestan Palace today. Oh, I have to rush. Getting prepared for today's tour. Golestan Palace, which dates back to more than 440 years ago, is one of the unique historical complexes of Iran. This palace, which belongs to the Zandian Qajar periods, is located in central Tehran. Golestan Palace was registered in Iran National Heritage List in 1956. It was also registered in the UNESCO Heritage List in 2013. Golestan Palace consists of several different structures, including Shamsul Emare, Salam Hall, Mirror Hall, the Marble Throne, Pond House, Abyas Palace, Karim Khani Nook, Building of Wind Catchers, as well as Ivory, Diamond and Brilliant Halls. The most important historical period of Golestan Palace was during the Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar era. He sat on his throne in this palace and chose Tehran as his capital in 1795. Nasiruddin Shah Qajar also sat on his throne in this palace and was the first king of Iran who had to travel to Europe. Therefore, Golestan Palace was affected by Western architecture because of this attitude of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. I am now on 15 Khordad Street. On Arya Square, Golestan Palace is located on the northern part of this square. Well, there are a few blocks to the palace, and of course, I enjoy taking a walk in the old texture of the city. I am now in the area of Golestan Palace. It's so beautiful. In front of me, there is a big pool which ends in Golestan Palace with its blue tides shining like a beautiful turquoise. Let's enter the palace. Sure, there are many amazing things waiting there for us. Mm-hmm. call. It's extraordinary, unique, breathtaking. It took more than 7 years to make the decorations of this hall. And I am now in the Ivan of the Marble Throne. This part is the oldest structure of Golestan Palace and dates back to Karim Khan Zand era. The most beautiful part of the Ivan is the Marble Throne, which was built by the order of Fatali Shah Qajar. He ordered Isfahani stone cutters to make a throne out of the yellow marble of Yazd in 1806. The throne has 65 big and small marble parts. Designing this throne, which looks like Prophet Solomon's throne, makes you think that the throne is situated on the shoulder of 3 demons and 6 angels. The beauties of Golestan Palace cannot be discussed in this brief radio program, but later in the future, I will come back here to describe other amazing parts of this palace. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.